This is tough to read, but as one source put it, quote, Bill's idea of sexual gratification involved more than intercourse. It was a blend of sadomasochism and filth, of pain and degradation. A witness to one of the sex sessions said he threw up afterwards.
That's repulsive on so many levels.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed, and for the past two decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who live through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun dun dun.
What is happening, crime crew? Welcome to episode number
72
of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, longtime TV producer Ed Hydock, along with the Wicked Witch of the West, Melissa Spivey.
I'll take that.
Well, it's Halloween season, so I feel it's only necessary to give you some kind of witch name.
I like it. She was a badass, so I'll take it.
It's true. Well, we are in a brand new month, but before we get into that, we want to share a few updates with you guys because I feel like you already might have some questions based on what you just heard in the past minute.
Mm-hmm.
To our regular listeners, you know we usually do a little bit of banter in the beginning of these episodes before we dive into the awfulness, and we're still going to do that, so do not worry, but we will be moving it to the end of the episode. We feel like after we talk about our case, it might be a nice little mini palate cleanser, maybe laugh a little bit before we part for the week.
I think it's a good way to end. And I feel like we also end up cutting so much of our pre-episode chatting out so the intro wasn't too long. And yeah, for the people who like just want us to get to the case, well, this episode so far doesn't seem like we're doing that. We promise we're taking you seriously.
Yes, that's exactly what the purpose of this is. We feel like it's going to help us branch out to some new audiences because we think that maybe people tuning in, you're not even getting to the story for the first 5 minutes. So I think as a listener, I would tune out too. And I don't think that we take that into account as much. Like, we love the product we're putting out, but I definitely think that jumping into things a little quicker will help things. And we're going to start doing that minus this week. We just needed to explain that.
Yes.
With that out of the way, it is October 2025, and we all know what that means.
New month, new block, new theme, and most importantly, spooky season is upon us.
That is absolutely correct. And our theme this month, we're going to call it Cursed by the Past, and it's going to center around haunted crime scenes.
Well, the inspiration for this episode came from a book entitled Haunted Crime Scenes, which was written by the patron saint of Murder Unscripted, Catherine Ramslin, and a gentleman named Mark Nesbitt. And the case I'm going to cover today is briefly mentioned in this book due to the paranormal activity that's been reported at the site where this case takes place. And essentially, the question here is, if a murder or something tragic happens, we already know that the psychological effects linger. We covered that last month. But
yep,
what else lingers? Like, are these sites now home to tragedy and the paranormal? Is there a bad energy that scars the property or the home or wherever it happened?
I certainly think so. I don't know what your take is on ghosts. I don't know if we've ever, in all the time we've known each other, I don't think we've ever talked about whether you believe in the paranormal or not.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel. That'll be an end of episode conversation.
Okay. I believe in energy. When someone dies, their energy lives on and you can feel them around you. I don't know.
I respect that. I mean, you know, I'm pretty negative about all things.
Yeah.
So, but again, end of episode conversation.
Yes.
All right, Ed, did you know that in the state of Pennsylvania, where we reside, realtors are not legally obligated to tell you if a murder occurred in the home you are purchasing?
They're not? I could have swore they were.
Nope. So
really?
There could have been like a brutal massacre, like in your bedroom where you lay your head at night. And technically, nobody has to tell you until you have that awkward conversation with the neighbor. but like you just move in thinking, damn,
got a good deal on this house.
That is kind of messed up, if you ask me. Like, can you imagine buying a new house and settling in one night? You decide to put on some true crime TV, like all of us do. And then when they show the outside of the home, you're like, that's my house. That is messed up. And I had no idea that that was a thing in Pennsylvania.
In most states, actually. Like, look it up. But most states have that same... They don't have to tell you.
What's that effect when you just thought you heard something your whole life? That's what I feel like I...
The Mandela effect?
Yeah, but it's not... I'm not seeing anything. I think I've just heard my whole life that the realtor has to tell you. And I don't think I ever just looked into it.
Nope, they do not.
Crazy.
And it's funny you bring up living in a house on a true crime documentary, because... That has actually happened, and it's happened more than once, actually twice.
Really?
Yeah, it happened twice in 2014. It happened at a home in Missouri, and it happened at another one in Texas. And the Texas case is like our main subject today, but I kind of want to quickly tell you about the Missouri case, because this is wild.
Yeah, tell me.
So it's 2014, and a young woman named Katrina McGall, she had recently rented a home in Ferguson, Missouri, which is like a suburb of St. Louis. And her landlord, this woman, Sandra Travis, she's like an older woman. She seems nice. And the woman actually even offered some furniture to Katrina, which she gladly accepted because furniture is ridiculously expensive. Like,
yes,
have you been to Raymour and Flanagan?
I have. And that's why I use Marketplace for everything. But God, talk about things that are probably haunted. Everything on Marketplace.
You're going to get like a haunted lazy boy.
What was that record player? Remember you sent me a haunted record player?
Oh, yeah. You need that.
I do.
Katrina signs this lease in March of 14. She moves in. She gets settled in her new home. All is well. Until one day, I think it was a relative of hers, suggests that Katrina watch this one episode of this true crime show. And the show spotlight, like, different serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very specific episode she wants Katrina to watch. So Katrina's like, okay, sure. So she gets home that night, sits down in front of her TV, starts watching. And it's an episode about a killer named Maury Travis. He was active in St. Louis in 2001.
Maury Troy Travis, to be exact. And I only know that because when I got on Forensic Files, they were doing a big Maury Troy Travis case. Was that the show that she watched?
No, I don't know what the show was. I couldn't find it. But this guy, this Maury guy, is a moron. Like, he got caught thanks to his own stupidity, but I'm not going to tell you anymore because this crime and his dumbassery, it could be a good Patreon episode. So stay
tuned
for that. Well, as Katrina starts watching the show, she's watching whatever. All of a sudden, she starts seeing a familiar backdrop. The home where an unknown number of women were tortured and murdered was the exact home that Katrina was living in.
Man, think about that, though. Someone shows
it's
you
terrifying.
That changes your world. I don't know if I'd be able to live there.
Well, hold on. We'll get to the end. And we don't even know actually how many victims Maury Travis had, but there is video evidence of him torturing women in his basement, which is now Katrina's basement.
God.
And in the true crime show she was watching, not only did she see her home, she saw the dining room table that the landlady had loaned her.
That is insane.
Isn't that wild?
Her head must have been spinning.
I would have probably run out of the house.
Yeah. Yeah. If you don't know those things, that's a shock.
That is such a shock. And she's,
and it's not like, and it's not even like a good memory. You're bringing up something that would make you really question whether or not you want to own that home.
And especially because I feel like it was so recent. Like, it was just in 2001 and this is 2014.
It's recent enough.
Well, Katrina is rightly horrified, and she confronts Sandra Travis, who, if you haven't put it together, that's Maury Travis's mom.
Right.
She's got to be so proud. Sandra tells her, she's basically like, yeah, so? I told you that when you signed the lease. And Katrina's like, okay, ma'am, you definitely did not. And, like, obviously I wasn't there, but I'm going to have to go team Katrina on this one. I'm pretty sure you would remember if your landlord told you that people were tortured to death in your house.
Yeah, not to mention if Sandra's trying to rent this space, there is zero chance she divulged everything that happened there. Zero.
Nobody would have taken it.
No.
And Sandra actually refused to let Katrina out of her lease, which is, I feel
up.
Like that's so shitty. Ultimately, the St. Louis Housing Authority had to get involved and, like, they were somehow able to convince Sandra to let Katrina break the renter's agreement.
Wow. Yeah. And I guess there's no legal repercussion if it's not against the law.
Exactly. Like,
crazy.
What can you do? Well, and Katrina, this is scary. Katrina would say that while she lived in the home, one of her 2-year-old relatives was visiting, and the kid and Katrina are in the basement and the little kid's playing. And it was right in the area where Mari had chained and tortured his victims. And like, suddenly the kid came visibly upset. And wow. Katrina would go on, she was interviewed, and she would go on to say, quote, she looked over and she's like, she's scared. Like, she saw somebody scared and crying, and nobody was there. End wow. quote. That's Isn't that wild. Scary?
It is scary. Like, I feel like kids and pets do that stuff too. Like, pets will yes. just look off in the distance and stare at something that's not there. It's like, what are you looking at, buddy?
Right? I hate when they do that.
Oh my God. Well, it's funny you bring that up because I looked into this for a different case. There are a few reasons that kids are like more in tune to this kind of stuff. And I think if I remember, it was like I know that they had vivid imaginations. That was one of them. And then mm-hmm. something about that children can have like a higher consciousness. I'm no, obviously, psychologist or expert, but you know what I mean? Like, it's something about their higher consciousness, that the meaning they're more attuned to like spirits and stuff. And also right. their upbringing, like if they were raised in a household that openly talked about ghosts and paranormal and stuff, that they're going to obviously be more accepting and maybe see some more of these things, even if they're not there because they're trained that way.
And in horror movies, it's always the creepy ass little kid who sees the ghost first. Always. Well, get this. I actually found the address to the home. I did some Google stalking and I found the home that Katrina was living in, which I'm not going to announce. Like, it's easy to find if you care. But it was just sold in August of 2025.
Oh, like a month ago.
Well, yeah, like this year. It was sold for $84,500. And the listing, I know, the listing said, quote, charming single family home with garage, spacious yard, and finished basement. End quote.
Yeah, thank God, because the old basement. Yeah, holy shit is right. Wow.
I'm like, I wouldn't even mention the basement, but okay. Zillow did note that the home was a bankruptcy property.
Oh, okay. So that might have something to do with it. Because that's cheap.
It is. I know. Isn't that wild? That, like, would yes. you live in a home that once played host to a brutal murder?
I don't know. I think it would depend on the circumstances. Like, maybe if it were a suicide, I would. But I think a murder has different energy, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. At the same token, getting a home for $84,500 these days.
True.
Just saying. Might be able to overlook the bad juju.
Hopefully you get like a nice ghost like Casper.
Yeah.
He seemed cool. Well, the whole murder is leaving bad energy behind. That brings me to my main case today. This case actually takes place in 1984, but we're going to start in 2014 with a gentleman named Nir Golan. And
what is it, Nir?
Nir, N-I-R.
Okay.
I think. How would you say it?
Nir? Yeah. It's just a weird name. Never heard that.
Yeah. Well, Nir Golan is a successful Texas gentleman, and he's like, you know what? I am tired of the daily grind. I need a place to just relax.
Same, bro.
same. So he gets a realtor, and they begin checking out homes, and he really wants to be in this town of Seabrook. And it's like an upper middle class suburb about 30 minutes south or so of Houston. Mm-hmm. So Golan decides to check out a home off of Toddville Road. And this home was built in 2006, and it's located in this like super bougie gated neighborhood called Villas by the Sea.
Oh.
And this neighborhood is made up of like Tuscany inspired and Mediterranean style, like McMansion type houses. And there's 13 homes in this little development. And the home Golan's looking at, it's literally waterside. Like, it's right on the Galveston Bay, which sounds amazing, right?
Yeah, it sounds really nice.
Exactly. And Mr. Golan thinks so too. And like, not only is this home absolutely lovely, it's got these beautiful views, but this multi-million dollar property is listed at a damn steal, especially for this area.
I would always question that. Like, why?
I would too. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Well, Golan signs the lease because he's renting it and he pays his whole deposit, which I'm guessing was probably first month's rent, last month's rent, and a security deposit. That's how it is around here. And I don't know for sure how much the monthly rent was. According to Zillow, the home was put up for rent a few times in 2014, and one of the listed rents was $5,300 a month.
It's still a lot.
Well, but a home in the same neighborhood in the same year was going for $5,900 a month. So okay. $600 difference.
It's quite a bit.
And I checked out what $5,900 would be in 2025 money, and we're looking at like $8,000 a month.
Wow. I mean, based on your description of the houses, I mean, that tracks.
That's wild.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Well, I think we can safely assume that Nir Golan put down a significant chunk of change for this deposit, even though, like, we know he got a deal.
Yeah.
So he's getting ready for move-in day when he finds out the very disturbing history of the property of his new home. So this house is not only built on the property of the infamous Todville Murder Mansion, also known as the Seabrook Murder Mansion.
Seabrook. Yeah, I've heard it called Seabrook.
Yeah, I've seen it both ways. I mostly refer to it as the Todville home in this episode.
Okay. It was on Todville Road, right?
Yes, it was. Yep.
Yeah.
So not only is it built on the property, but there are reports that this home that he rented is where the mansion actually stood.
Oh,
and
okay.
Like, yeah, and I couldn't corroborate that with anything legit, but I did see it on several message boards from users claiming to either have lived in the area or even in the neighborhood where the mansion was standing. So take that for what it's worth.
Was he new to the area? Because I feel like that was such a high profile thing that he would know about it.
You know what, though? This case was incredibly hard to research. There was very, very little information on it. So maybe he didn't know about it.
Yeah. And I know just about it, but I don't really know about it, if that makes sense.
Right.
Like, I'm familiar with the case, but not really.
This was probably the most sparsely like written about case that I've ever done.
Oh, good. Can't wait.
It's good. I promise.
Some watered down research.
No, this is damn good. Just all watch.
Right. I trust
I read
you.
A book. Okay.
Oh,
well, let's take a trip back to 1984, where neon wasn't a color. It was a lifestyle. It was a whole ass vibe.
You're damn right it was.
Now, keep in mind, this is one of those cases where we have a murder victim, but there's a very, very gray area, I think, with vigilante justice. So,
yeah.
Think it through and we can decide at the end.
Okay.
So before I get into the major players in this case, I need to kind of describe the situation we're in. It's Houston, Texas. It's in the early 1980s. And the 60s and 70s had been super prosperous for the oil industry, and they experienced what is known as an oil glut, which I didn't know what that meant, so I had to look it up.
It's a glut is an in excess of something, like gluttony?
Yes, it basically means that they have way more oil than consumers actually need.
Right.
So this leads to the prices dropping, which leads to a downturn in economy and massive layoffs. And I read in one source that the oil bust of the 1980s nearly broke Houston.
Well, yeah, think about how much that city relies on oil production.
So much. So this was a huge deal. And one section of Houston that suffered greatly from layoffs and the poor economy was the Montrose neighborhood. So in the 1970s, so the decade prior, Montrose had become like an epicenter for the LGBTQA+ community. And sources say the neighborhood became super eclectic and it was very vibrant. And I believe Montrose is still super artsy and eclectic, and it's still a haven for the LGBTQA+ crowd. However, by the 1980s, again, in part of the oil bust, there was like a not so great section of Montrose that became a rough neighborhood. We had young, like homeless teens and 20 somethings, and they would sell drugs or sell themselves, sadly, to make money. And many of these young people had drug addictions, which just made them hustle on the streets even harder.
Yeah.
One source said, quote, "Unfortunately, Montrose was also becoming a magnet for drug addicts, prostitutes, runaways, gay bashers, and thrill seekers during the 1980s, end quote.
Nowhere is a fire department emergency medical technician put to a tougher test than in Houston's Fifth Ward.
Yeah, he had a lung, bro.
He cut you with a bottle, huh?
No, he hit him in the back of the head. You know how people, they grab it and stuff.
Yeah.
This wouldn't be, I don't like nobody grabbing me.
This makes you kind of wonder what's the use of it. You try to, you scrounge to buy a good house in a decent neighborhood. You bust your tail to work so you can take care of your family and do things. And then you get somebody like this with no identification, no nothing, that can tear it all up in a minute.
Wow, sounds charming.
Yeah, sounds scary. Jeez. Now, I just want everyone to keep in mind, I have never been to Houston, let alone Montrose. So this information is kind of like a modgepodge of articles and Google Maps and different online forums.
A hodgepodge? Hodgepodge. Mod Podge is that stuff they put on artwork to like make it last.
I love that stuff. I thought it was interchangeable. Like you could just like add an odd word and it was fine. No.
And it's mod, M-O-D. It's not even Modge. Janet Modge it's closer to Janet Modge than it is to.
Did I make Modge Podge up? I'm going to keep using it.
Well, please don't. Get on with the story.
Moving on. So I use articles, Google Maps, and different online forums and posts to kind of put this all together. And what I found, Montrose has a main drag, if you will, called Westheimer. And this road is apparently 19 miles long. It goes from east to west, and it cuts through the center of Montrose. And the understanding that I came to, and again, this was back in the 80s, so I don't know what it's like today, but there was a 10-block section of the street in Montrose, and it started out really cool and eclectic, and there were bars and clubs and funky stores. And like, as you went down the street, it slowly got seedier, like towards the lower end. Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that specifically the 200 block was really not the best section of town. Okay. And like, if you wanted to get drugs or hire a sex worker, this is where you would go and you would cruise this road. So drugs are a big thing right now, especially in this section of town. And the drug of choice was crank. And I'm confused because I thought crank was meth.
It is.
But I heard another podcast and in an article, they said that crank is the drug that results from boiling nasal spray.
Were the podcast hosts on crank? Because it's definitely meth.
Possibly.
Wow.
Well, if you Google it, it comes up as meth. And like, I did Google the nasal spray thing. So now I'm probably never allowed to buy NyQuil or Afrin again. I'm on some government list.
And that's the least of your worries about what's in your search history. God.
Fair. Well, either way, crank is the drug du jour. Hmm. So that's kind of the backdrop to our case today. And now I can tell you about everybody in it. So the first person we got to talk about is Smiley, a.k.a. Albert Irvin Hobart. Hmm. Smiley within his... He went by Smiley. That was his nickname.
Wonder why.
I'll get to it.
Okay.
So he was in his late teens at the time of our story. He had been born to a 16-year-old mother who was like apparently in an arranged marriage. And I don't think Smiley ever had a whole lot to do with his dad. And then his mom would go on to marry, divorce, and so on. And according to Smiley, like each stepdad was worse than the last one.
That stinks.
And I do think that Smiley was kind of born with a chip on his shoulder. Like, he seemed to really want to be successful and be somebody and make something of himself. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem like he wanted to work very hard for it. And, like, he wasn't a dumb kid, but he didn't do very well in school. He's always getting into fights with other kids, and he's, like, disrespecting the teachers and authority figures. But when he was about 14 years old, he was hit by a car, and he ended up, like, on death's door.
Really?
His pelvis and leg were shattered. Apparently, the doctors went to his mom and they were like, you should probably start making end-of-life plans.
Oh, wow. So that was serious, like really serious.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the craziest part, this is such a shame. He was on that road helping someone who had been in a car accident. Like, I didn't write the exact story down, but he was helping the accident victim out of their car, and another driver hit him while he was doing that.
That's awful. And we hear that all the time, but you also can't live your life not wanting to help people because of possible tragedy. Something like that you can't control.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so sad. And it had such an effect moving forward, I think. Mm-hmm. And I mean, fortunately, he survived, which is great.
Yes.
And I think that right after it happened, he was like, holy shit, I got a second chance and I'm not going to waste it. And at this point, he really had aspirations of becoming a cop or a lawyer or something in like the criminal justice field. But that epiphany did not last very long. And it didn't help that the accident left him with a limp, which he was teased for.
Well, yeah. And he probably, I'm guessing, missed a ton of school. So he was like behind in his classes then, too, because if he was out with all these injuries.
Exactly. I mean,
didn't help.
yeah, so that made it even worse, especially because he wasn't a great student to begin with. So things not only got worse at school, but also at home. And then Smiley added drugs to the mix, which ultimately led him to doing speed and heroin.
Jeez, didn't mess around.
Right? That's like a big jump. But yeah. he ended up dropping out of high school the following year when he was 15 years old.
God, 15.
I know. And eventually his mother had had enough of him. And at some point in 1982, Smiley was about 17 years old at this point. His mom threw him out of the house.
That's not going to end well.
No, not for anybody. And this is when he began frequenting that Montrose neighborhood I told you about. And it was living on the streets where he got his name. One source said, quote, he understood the necessity of having charm. He was able to lie with ease, able to flash his toothy grin that made folks want to believe him. He's the sort of kid who you wanted to trust even though everything in your gut says not to, end quote.
He's a car salesman.
Exactly. And I feel like everybody knows somebody like that where you're like.
I know a lot of people like that.
No comment. Well, after a while, Smiley was able to snag a coveted spot living in this youth shelter called the Covenant House.
Oh, that's still around. I've heard of that before.
I randomly just saw a commercial last night for one.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
So their mission statement says, quote, Covenant House, Texas provides homeless and runaway youth a safe haven from the dangers of street life and abuse, as well as provide them with the necessary skills, training, and emotional support to choose positive life alternatives and develop into self-sufficient adults, end quote.
It's a great mission.
Yeah, and they provide like educational and vocational training. And from what I read, the kids can live, like they're fed and they're clothed, but they can live there until you're like 24 years old.
I feel like that's the age range where like a lot of your problems can start and really manifest and fester. So that's a great age to get these kids on the right path.
It really is. And I mean, it seems like a really good organization. I didn't look too far into it, but well, Smiley's pumped. He gets in the Covenant House and he's actually doing pretty well. He makes friends with a 16-year-old kid named Robert Brown, and his nickname was Zero. And Zero has a very sad story. Apparently, when he was 13 years old, his mom lost her job and she basically said, can't afford you anymore, so you should probably just get out.
Do people even consider that? Like, why, when you have kids, you know damn well they're expensive. Like, I think the average cost to raise a kid to 18 is $250,000. And that was years ago when I heard that stat. So God knows what it is today.
Oh, I think it's way higher. I feel like it's closer to $1 million.
Oh, my God. Yeah, talk to
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Well, this poor kid is like barely a teenager and his twat waffle of a mother kicks him to the curb. Like, that is the piss poor parenting.
Yeah.
And so in order to make ends meet, Zero began earning money as a sex worker at 13 years old.
God, do you know how bad that probably messed him up? Like, obviously he was doing what he had to do, but it's way too young to be immersed in a world that you don't know anything about.
I know. It's so sad. And I don't ultimately know what happened to him, but from where the story goes, I don't think anything good. But he and Smiley met at the Covenant House, and they decided to get clean together. And that is incredibly admirable. However, Smiley did that a lot. He would vow to get sober dozens of times, but within a few days, he would fall off the wagon.
Most addicts do. But I think when they have a coach or a partner or something like a sponsor, somebody that keeps them accountable, I think that really goes a long way. From everything I know, two alcoholics, former alcoholics, and they've only gotten through with the help of a sponsor.
Well, and that's what these guys were kind of, I feel like, hoping they could be for one another.
Yeah.
And that's what Smiley thought. Like, it's going to be different this time. I have a sobriety partner. This is going to be a brand new life. The boys go to what I'm assuming is an AA or an NA meeting. I think it said like a substance abuse meeting, but it didn't give a specific name.
Okay.
So this is great, right? They make a promise to get themselves clean. And unlike before, Smiley is actively taking steps to meet that goal. And he goes to the first meeting. But the night the boys went to the meeting, it ended a little bit later than normal, which caused them to miss curfew at the Covenant House. And with that, both of them were kicked out.
You're kidding me. Like, that's not even fair. Like, couldn't the meeting people call the Covenant House and be like, hey, so, like, almost like getting a doctor's note?
Yeah, right? Like, hey, we let out late tonight.
Yeah.
I know. Now, there was nothing in research about any things leading up to this at the Covenant House. I don't know that they were perfect angels or that they did anything, but they ended up getting kicked out. And as soon as they're back out on the streets, they're back on crank. So one day they decided to carjack a kid in a Jeep for whatever reason. So they're hanging out at this convenience store. They see this kid and they must have asked him for a ride. But after a few blocks, they didn't just steal his Jeep. They brutally assaulted this poor 18-year-old kid and essentially left him for dead.
That's awful. That's quite a leap.
Yeah. I don't know what is going on in their heads, but this poor kid wakes up hours later in like an abandoned lot. He's beaten and bruised and bloody, and he even had footprints on his chest and face, like they were stomping on him.
Jesus. And it makes you, I don't know what happens at the end of this story, but if that Covenant House wouldn't have kicked them out,
I know.
Maybe everything you're about to say next turns out differently.
I know. I wish. Well, so they steal this kid's Jeep and eventually they decide they need some money. So they decided to rob a store for money, which isn't great, but they decided to rob a martial arts establishment.
Of all the places.
I don't want to make assumptions, but I feel like the employee at a martial arts place might know martial arts.
I would say so.
Like, if I had to pick a place to rob, it would not be a martial arts studio or a gun store, like an archery depot. Is that a thing?
I would do like a Build-A-Bear.
Yes. That would be safe to rob. Don't do it, guys. Don't do it.
No, don't.
Yeah. And our martial arts employee was really not trying. He was not having it that day because he had a gun.
Wow.
He ends up scaring them away with the gun. So like they take off before anything happens. But they end up going back to the Montrose area and Zero begins bragging about how they killed a guy. So that makes me think they do think they killed that poor kid.
Guy running his mouth again.
Yep. Well, somebody tipped off police and Smiley and Zero were arrested almost immediately. And Zero, he still had the bloody knife he used to stab the kid, like in his pocket.
What an idiot.
Yeah, it was still bloody everything. So this is kind of where Zero leaves us. I'm not sure what happens after that. But Smiley would spend the next 48 days in county jail. And he was miserable.
Like, yeah, because you know what they don't have in jail? Drugs.
Well, yeah. And like for a kid who was just so confident and cocky out on the street, jail scared the absolute shit out of him.
Yeah, prison will knock you down.
Yep. So when he was offered a plea deal, 10 years probation, he was like, absolutely, yep, I promise I'll be good.
Whatever you want, yep.
Anything you want. But his promises to be better are like my promises to be nicer.
Didn't work out, huh?
Never gonna happen. Yeah. So for the next couple years, Smiley's doing his usual shit. He's promising to do better, and then he spirals downward. He would get a job and then lose it just as quickly. He's heavily addicted at this point to shooting up crank and heroin, and he would get so high so he could, quote, still turn tricks, steal, or peddle the leftovers, end quote.
What a life.
Like, you know how I like to say that rock bottom has a basement?
Yeah.
Well, at this point, Smiley is in a crawl space underneath that basement. He had broken probation, and at this point, he's hiding out from the cops. He's so pathetic. He starts mugging people for cigarettes.
Oh, man.
That's some rock bottom crawl space shit right there.
It really is, and it just shows how dangerous desperate people can be.
Yep. But Smiley's luck was just about to change. Kinda. So in late September, early October of 84, Smiley meets 19-year-old Tim. And he's chatting with Tim, and Tim asks Smiley if he wants to go for a ride with him and this guy, Bill. And this is just what happens in Montrose. Like, this is, people get picked up,
normal.
Whatever.
Yeah, very normal.
So Smiley agrees, but when this Bill guy pulls up, he's in this fancy schmancy sports car. Smiley realizes he knows this guy, and not for anything good.
Uh-oh.
This guy would frequent Montrose, picking up young men and paying them for sex. But Smiley knew this man was loaded. And we talked earlier about how Smiley had always like dreamed of being wealthy. So this opportunity comes along and he takes full advantage.
He knows the game. So he sees money and he's going to do whatever it takes.
I will say Smiley made it clear to Bill that he was not available for sex. Like, he would come live at the mansion and cook and clean, but he was not going to have sex with them.
That's a great deal.
Right? Well, is it? Oh. So Bill agrees. And at that point, Tim, Smiley, and Bill, they head out of Montrose. So who is Bill? And what does he and these street kids have to do with Near Golan and the supposedly haunted upper middle class neighborhood in Seabrook, Texas?
Tell me.
All right. At the center of our case is William Gerald List, who went by Bill. And at the time of our case, he's in his mid to late 50s. I think he's about 57-ish. And he is an incredibly wealthy and successful businessman. He had made bank money during the oil boom in the late 60s and the 70s. He actually had manufactured, sold, and rented truck trailers that could haul the big sections of pipelines.
Oh, yeah. You see him driving down the highway.
Yeah. Well, one source actually said he had the patent on like this specific type of trailer.
Really?
So this was big, big money. Yeah. But as we know, money cannot buy class or decency. And this guy is a monster.
It's a fact.
So Bill List reminds me very much of John Wayne Gacy in certain aspects.
That's not good.
No, not at all. And like List was a loud bragger and we know Gacy was, but Bill definitely didn't have like the charisma and schmoozing skills that Gacy was so known for. Mm-hmm. List was abrasive. He was difficult to get along with. And I don't have much on List's childhood. I know he was born in August of 1927 in Mejia, Texas. Mm-hmm. He had dropped out of school in the ninth grade. And at some point he joined the military. So he was a World War II Navy veteran.
Oh, okay.
Now, going back to Gacy, List was a gay man who had a fascination with much younger, I don't even want to say men, but boys.
It's like which, Gacy.
Just like Gacy, would get him in trouble. So we'll come back to that in a minute. So List would tell a prison psychiatrist that he had known he was gay since he was about 8 years old. However, he would remain pretty closeted for a long time. At some point in the late 1940s or early 50s, Bill was married to a woman named Harriet, and the couple had two kids, Ron and Deborah. This marriage would end, as did his relationship with his children, because in 1959, he was sent to prison for molesting teenage boys.
Oh, gross.
Yeah, this is when he spoke to that prison psychiatrist I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And it was at this point that Harriet divorced his ass, and she and the two kids, like, not only did they change their names, but I'm pretty sure they moved out of state.
Good.
Just like Gacy's first wife and kids.
But wouldn't you?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Bill would remain estranged from his children until the early 1980s. And it's so crazy how these true crime cases intertwine, but there's a whole separate true crime story involving Bill's daughter, which I'll mention to you at the end. Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh my God.
And it's a very famous case, which is even crazier.
John List?
No, different. Not John List. Well, but for at this point in our story, he's estranged from his kids. So in 1962, he was released from prison and he hightailed it back to Texas. And anybody thinks that this prison stint rehabilitated him? Sexual predators cannot be rehabilitated.
Agree with that.
Yep. And B, I have a Nigerian prince who needs your help, and you just need to send us your bank account information.
Hey, wait, you got that email too? I'm still waiting on my check. I gave him everything. Now I'm checking the mailbox, just waiting.
I think you should probably keep checking it. Well, Bill wasn't just a sick pedophile rapist. He was also a sadomasochist pedophile rapist.
Oh.
If you're into BDSM, that's awesome. Get crazy. We've made it abundantly clear we don't kink shame here. But the key to that is having a consenting adult as a
adult.
Partner.
Exactly.
And consenting. That's a big one, too.
That's.
But Bill List didn't give a flying F about his partners being adults, much less being consenting adults.
Gross.
This is tough to read, but as one source put it, quote, Bill's idea of sexual gratification involved more than intercourse. It was a blend of sadomasochism and filth, of pain and degradation. A witness to one of the sex sessions said he threw up afterwards, end quote.
That's repulsive on so many levels, because I know we're not talking about two adults here.
Exactly. There were actually sources that said we will not, like, that came out at the time that they were like, we will not write the disgusting things that he did. Like, I was like, holy shit.
Yeah, you don't need to. Dad. I think you get the picture.
Yeah. There isn't a ton of information about List's life at this point. We know he had been successful in Ohio, and he was even more successful in Texas with this trailer business. At some point in like the late 70s, Bill decided that he wanted to build a home to show off all his wealth and success. So he began construction of what would become known as the Toddville Murder Mansion or the Seabrook Murder Mansion. And I don't even know that mansion, though, is the word that I should be using. I feel like compound would be a better choice. This house is 34,000 square feet.
God, that's humongous. Like, picture how big that is.
I Googled the average square footage of a single family home in the U.S.
It's probably like
2,500.
2,500? Yeah, that's even more than I thought it was. 2,500
square feet. His house is 14 times the average United States home size.
I never understood that. Like, you can't live in all of that space at the same time, and someone has to clean it. But at the same time, like, if you can afford that house, you can probably afford a house cleaner.
It sounds like so much work.
Yeah. Why? Just to show off.
Well, and I don't know what he thought he was showing off, because this home was hideous. The Houston Chronicle did an article about this case, and they said, quote, it was a grotesque monument to the success of Bill List, the businessman who built it and lived there with his houseboys, end quote. So this home is three stories, and it's completely built out of brick and iron. He used 175 tons of steel to build this monstrosity. And keep in mind, while this is being built, all the other homes in the area, they're like small beach houses, and they're all built on stilts because this is on the water, but
right,
not this enormous waterfront eyesore. It was horrible.
Yeah, nothing says home like a cross between a factory and a prison.
That's exactly what it looked like. Yep.
God.
And when it was being built, neighbors actually thought it was going to be an apartment building. Like, they saw the foundation being laid.
Well, yeah,
because
it's so huge.
Yeah, and they were like, apartment's coming.
Nope, one guy.
So this home was located at 3300 Toddville Road, and you'd come up to, like, this big gate and a super long driveway, and he has a reflecting pool, like, the length of the driveway. And then at the end of this long-ass driveway is this terrifying building that... It almost reminds you of, like, an insane asylum from some horror movie. Like, if you were to see it, that's what I would think it is. Every window had bars on it. Even the balconies and verandas, which there were several, they had bars around them.
Sounds stupid. So,
it's so stupid. So, the home is split into two wings, and it has this giant atrium in the middle. And, like, if you were on the second floor of this home... There was a huge catwalk connecting the two wings together, and the catwalk went through the atrium.
Wow.
It kind of looked like a hotel. And then the 40-foot indoor pool was also in the atrium, and there was a jacuzzi on, like, one of the second-floor balconies, and it, like, overflowed into the pool, creating this waterfall. Like, this is so exorbitant and ridiculous.
I take it all back. It sounds awesome.
I feel like we're watching an episode of Cribs. Remember that show? So there were, like, fountains in this atrium, and the stairs wrapped around a fountain. It was like a double staircase, and the home had this huge ballroom. And on the bottom floor, it had a big game room complete with, like, a pool table and a 20-foot bar. Like, who needs that?
I know. It's just like a model of opulence, you know? It's like literally just to show off. You do not need all that house.
Get this. The home had this huge dining room that held a 30-foot table. And it even had a big-ass steam table with a sneeze guard, like you would see at a buffet. So, yeah, like, this house is ridiculous. And then Bill's room, his room, was more like a separate apartment. Like, his quarters even had a kitchen in it.
Wow.
As I stated earlier, money cannot buy class, because in addition to the design of the home being ugly, both, like, the interior and exterior, the home was very sparsely furnished. Bill was an incredibly cheap man. Like, he didn't believe in shampoo or shaving cream. He just used bar soap for everything.
But then why spend all this money on this house?
I have no idea. So he builds this ridiculous house and that doesn't have anything in it?
Makes no sense.
Well, don't worry, because one day a local hotel went out of business and Bill List took full advantage of this and he bought the majority of the hotel furniture.
Oh, so it looked like a Marriott.
Yeah, so like not only did every room look the same, but they were all straight 1970s Holiday Inn chic. Like lots of tweed couches and nondescript bed frames and dressers. And of course, it included the obligatory ugly hotel water painting.
Oh my God, and a Bible in every dresser? Yeah.
I'm sure, yes.
Wow.
So Bill builds this monstrosity and moves in. And I think the reason he had moved to Texas was to escape his reputation in Ohio as being the sick pedophile rapist that he was. But really, this was just a way for him to find new victims. And he definitely did. He began cruising the streets of Houston, specifically like the rough section of Montrose.
I would guess, right? You mentioned
exactly.
All these, what, that's the hunting grounds.
And this is sad, but there were no shortage of teenage boys who were ready to be like sugar babies.
Mm-hmm.
This is long before Julia Roberts and Richard Gere, but I feel like a lot of these kids were hoping for like a Pretty Woman ending.
Yeah, where they fall in with the right person and get treated like royalty.
Yeah, like you meet a rich sugar daddy and everybody lives happily ever after. And maybe that happened for some. I like to think it did. But it did not happen for anyone who got into Bill List's car.
Mm-hmm.
So boys would go with List and he would offer them room and board in addition to alcohol and drugs in exchange for them to become his, quotes, houseboys.
They're the worst kind of people that prey on vulnerability.
Yep. So these boys would take on the role of housekeeper. They would cook, they would clean, and a lot of them would become Bill's victims. And whether or not the boys consented to having sexual relations with Bill List, they were definitely not ready and consenting for his sadistic tastes.
Yeah, I feel like anything they learned on the streets paled in comparison to what they were about
100%, to get yes. into. And a lot of the boys would stay there as long as they could, but they'd eventually have to escape. And remember, this mansion is like in the middle of nowhere right now. Like there's no cell phones, there's no Ubers. So if Liz takes you to this house of horrors, you're kind of stuck there.
Well, yeah. And Montrose and Seabrook, they're like not close, like not walking distance. Yeah.
No, it's like 40 minutes.
Oh, yeah. So you're not, they're in big trouble.
You're stuck. I mean, what are you going to do? And it's not like you can even call a cab because you don't have any money.
No.
So I want to get back to that fall night in 1984 when Smiley crossed paths with Tim and Bill List. And Bill had picked both of them up with the agreement that Tim was available for sex. And while Smiley wasn't, he was willing to earn his keep by cooking and cleaning. So they pull up to this monstrosity of a home and Smiley is freaking flabbergasted. Like he had never seen such wealth and opulence.
I don't think many people have.
No, you're right. Well, when Bill and the boys get there, he tells the boys, just go ahead and find a bedroom and make yourself at home. Like have a good one. So the next day, Smiley and Tim met the two other young men that were already living in the home and acting as Bill's houseboys. And these men were 22-year-old Jeffrey Stanton and a 16-year-old kid named Joey. Jeffrey was kind of like the head housekeeper, I guess. He had been living in Bill's home for a while, I think about 9 months. And I don't have a ton about his life prior to the mansion. I know he had spent some time in prison for stealing a car, and he had been committed to a mental health facility at some point.
Okay.
But when Jeff originally came into the house, he came with his 17-year-old boyfriend, Lance, and the agreement was that Jeffrey would run the household and Lance would be Bill's victim. Let's be honest, that's what they were. But eventually, Lance confided to Jeff that Bill was a monster in the bedroom and he couldn't do it anymore.
Wow.
And really, this happened often. And once Bill discovered his victim wasn't going to be a victim anymore, kicked him right out of the house. And then he brought Joey in. So it's like a revolving door.
Cycle. Yep.
Yep. So I'm going to get back to Joey in a sec, but back to Jeff. He was described as a very laid-back guy. He was kind of the only one who could keep Bill under control, I guess is the way to put it. Bill would have these wild mood swings. And remember, he was just like a dick in general. But
yeah,
it seems like Jeff took everything in stride and he really didn't let Bill rattle him. And I'm sure it helped that Bill kept Jeff high as a kite on drugs like heroin.
Well, yeah, and isn't that what Gacy did too, but with booze? Mm-hmm. Like, because yep, it really makes people easy to control when they're under the influence.
Exactly. So in this house, Jeff is kind of like at the top of the hierarchy of Bill's victims. And then we have 16-year-old Joey, and he had been brought into the house just about 2 weeks prior to Smiley and Tim coming along. And just an FYI, List had originally lured Joey to the home by telling him that he would pay Joey $100 a week to clean the mansion, which is $310 in 2025 money. Mm. And in addition to Joey getting paid, he would also get room and board. Mm, so he's a free place to live, free place to, like,
not a bad deal, minus the sex dungeon part, but yeah.
Well, he didn't mention that part to Joey, but it didn't take long for Joey to realize that Bill kept those job requirements to himself, and Joey essentially became his sex slave.
Mm. Awful.
And I feel like I should mention this part. Bill would pick up young boys, and like I said, some of them stuck around, a lot didn't, and this is where rumors began to swirl that Bill was killing these boys, which, like, kind of led to the Murder Mansion moniker. Mm-hmm. However, and I am not standing up for Bill List, he's an infected pile of pus, but there is no proof nor any real documentation that he ever actually killed someone. And, like, I wouldn't put it past him. I honestly don't think it happened, though. I think it just became part of the story, like how scary campsite ghost stories always seem to get scarier, like something gets added through the years.
Yeah, I don't know enough about him except that this stuff that you're talking about in regards to his, like, sexual proclivities, so I don't really can't speak to him about, like, having a murderous streak, so I don't want to go there because there's a big leap between. But, I mean, the one thing you can count on is that he's picking these kids that were down on their luck, so they were off the grid, they weren't exactly being looked for by people, so that's probably how rumors and lore starts.
Yeah. I don't personally think he did, but we don't know. And at this point, we'll probably never know.
Yeah.
If we break this down, we have one disgusting sexual deviant with deep pockets and deep perversions, and a tempered arrival Alec Baldwin leaving a voicemail.
Oof, that's bad.
Yikes. And then we have these four street kids who are stuck doing the cooking, the laundry, and oftentimes the sexual favors for this monstrous millionaire. But remember, they're mostly kept mellowed with all the drugs and alcohol that they want. But drugs only keep you mellow for so long, especially Smiley, who we already know had like a chip on his shoulder towards the world. And this anger within Smiley began to spread like a cancer within him the longer he stayed with Bill. Like, he not only hated Bill, but he also resented him. Like, here's this absolute porta potty of a human, a rapist, a pedophile felon, but he's basically living the dream. He's got the monies, he's got cars, he's got the mansion, and
it's the life he wants, minus all the bad stuff.
Well, yeah, because then he's got the condescending and degrading way of treating the boys, which, you know, and he sees these boys like as his employees, but also his belongings. So all of this is building up inside Smiley, and it did not take long for his jealousy and anger to just reach a complete boiling point. Mm. And then you add in the drugs and alcohol, and holy shit, that's explosive.
Yes, nothing good will come from this, whatever comes next. Mm.
So by now, Smiley and Tim hadn't been in the mansion very long. Sources differed anywhere between a few days to a few weeks. But regardless of how long it was, Smiley had reached his breaking point. And on October 17th, 1984, Bill got up as usual. He ate breakfast with the boys. Jeff always cooked this huge breakfast for everyone. And then Bill left for work. But prior to leaving, he left the daily list of chores for the boys to do. And apparently on that day, he wanted them to like scrub the tiles in the ballroom or something. So the boys are awake. They have their breakfast and then their other breakfast of illegal drugs. But instead of going to tackle their chore list, they begin talking. And remember, they're high. They start talking about Bill List and how awful he is and how badly he treated them. And we all know that a toxic attitude can spread like the plague.
Yeah, it can.
And this is what makes this case so tough for me. If a rape victim kills their attacker, it is really, really hard to say, oof, you shouldn't have done that. Like,
yeah,
kind of like I said at the beginning, vigilante justice is a gray area. I understand it, but it can be so wrong.
Yeah, I definitely have more thoughts on this, but I've heard stories of people walking in on someone molesting their daughter and they do really bad things to that molester.
Yes.
You side with that person because damn right. But murder is still a very heinous crime, no matter what led up to it. So it's a very touchy area.
It's like I said, this case is a giant gray area. So by now the boys are very high, they're very drunk, and they're very angry. And they're just getting angrier and angrier. And they decide to start venting these frustrations by destroying the mansion.
Oh.
So I mentioned the atrium. Well, it was filled with potted plants and window boxes.
Yeah, I feel like that's a good place to start with all the... I'm picturing like a greenhouse. Smash yeah. those windows. Yep.
Well, they begin breaking the windows, breaking like all the potted plants. They're taking the potted plants and like taking them up to the catwalk and throwing them in the pool.
Oh, wow.
And then the boys just continue this hurricane of destruction. They start destroying light fixtures and chandeliers. They take the dishes from the kitchen and start like frisbeeing them through windows.
No kidding. They're just going hog wild. Like, it's like every boy's dream. Like if this didn't have obviously bigger repercussions, like go in a house and just trash it. They make those rooms now, those smash
the rage rooms.
The rage rooms, yeah.
I need one. I feel like I need one.
I agree.
I do. Well, the boys like took it another, like they went hard. Like they apparently pulled food out of the fridge and just threw it all over the home, Smeared it on the walls. One source actually said they were throwing furniture in the pool and they took like a glass tabletop and threw it from a third floor bedroom window into the atrium. So like when it just exploded. It exploded into like millions of glass shards. I mean, they didn't just trash this house. Like, they obliterated it.
Yes, they did.
And one thing that they did, and I understand it's totally wrong, but it would be super cool to see, they added a bunch of laundry detergent to the jacuzzi and the fountains, which would be so cool.
But speaking as a dad, that'll clog your jets. That's a crime punishable by death. It's going to ruin that pump.
Damn it! I don't care that you killed the guy, but now you drew a line.
Now it's serious. Wow.
Well, after they took out their wrath on this home, the boys got back to the other task at hand. Doing all the drugs and drinking all the alcohol.
I feel like that's not a great idea. Because if Bill comes home and sees this mess, I mean, he's not going to be happy. So when he takes his rage out on you, like being high and drunk might not be the best, like run and disappear and don't come back.
Well, we get there in a little bit, but unfortunately we don't just leave.
No.
So during this post-destruction hangout, Joey breaks down and he tells the other guys about how Bill had been raping him. And like by now, Jeff had told Bill to leave Joey alone. Like he went to him and said, leave him alone. And apparently Bill promised Jeff he would, but clearly he didn't. And Joey went into details that I'm not going to share, but it sounds like he was sexually tortured.
Wow.
And remember, Joey's the youngest. He's only 16. And I think the boys kind of looked at him a bit like a younger brother.
I just can't imagine being exposed to that level of sexual deviance at that young age.
I can't either. This admission of abuse, it just adds fuel to this already raging inferno of anger and hate. And now destroying the home was just not enough for the boys. Like, they wanted to destroy Bill.
Yeah, they're pissed.
And again, this is hard. I don't want to say I don't see where they're coming from. This guy's terrible, but murder is wrong. But also think about this rapist monster not only getting away with these horrible acts, but he's also out there living the damn life.
Yeah, and you have to think about the fact that these kids are basically kids from the street. And you have this guy with all this wealth. Who are they going to believe?
Well, that too.
If they went to cops.
It sucks because bad people shouldn't be rewarded, and yet we all know life isn't fair, and some of the worst people often have the most power and wealth.
Yeah, it's good to be king, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. So this is where the boys begin planning the murder of Bill List. And, like, they're obviously not thinking clearly.
Yeah, murderers rarely are.
Well, and they're also high as a kite, so that doesn't help. But these guys didn't put an ounce of thought into how this murder plan was going to work.
They're so young.
They certainly Yeah. And they certainly didn't try to hide their tracks. Like, Smiley even took a permanent marker and wrote on the wall of the home, quote, "Bill List is a very sick man. He is going to die. Smiley, 1984.
He signed it?
He signed it.
Okay.
So these boys are no criminal geniuses here.
No.
So their next move is to go get one of Bill's guns and a box of ammo, and they choose one of his shotguns. And they decided that they were going to shoot Bill as soon as he walked into the home after work. So they had the where, the when, and the weapon. Now they needed to pick the who. Who's going to be the triggerman?
I would assume Smiley, given that he's kind of down for anything.
Ding, 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 ding. Yeah. And I think by now, Smiley believed that killing Bill wasn't a choice, but the only option. Like, he knew that if Bill came home and saw
and
this
saw that house?
Obliterated mansion.
Yeah.
Yeah. The boys would be in big trouble. Mm. And whether Smiley thought that meant with authorities or something else, I honestly don't know. So Bill gets home same time every day, 5:45, and he enters through like the same door every day. And some sources describe the layout of where he came in and where he was shot. I don't really get it, but all you need to know is that Smiley was perched on the catwalk with like a direct line to where he knew Bill would walk in the door.
Okay.
So 5:45 on the dot, Bill pulls in the driveway, parks his sports car, and walks inside. And most sources say that he must have had at least a minute or two to see the destruction caused by the boys. And like, it must have started to register in his mind. But just as he was like trying to make sense of the situation, Smiley aims the shotgun at Bill's head and pulls the trigger.
Wow.
Bill threw his hands went up to his head, and within seconds he was on the ground, just dead, like lying in a pool of blood.
You don't come back from a shotgun to the face.
No. So Jeff, who had been in his room this whole time, he heard the gunshot and he ran towards the crime scene, and he arrived just in time to see Smiley urinating on Liz's dead body.
What?
That's a class act.
That is some pure hatred right there. Like, that's next level.
Yeah. I was like, did you really need to do that?
Yeah.
Like,
you already,
that was, yeah.
But if they're on drugs too, who knows?
That's true. So the boys pack real quick and they leave the home and they steal Liz's sports car. And just a weird little trivia fact, apparently one of the young men put a Tina Turner cassette tape in the player while they made their getaway.
Oh.
One source said it was break all the rules.
Very cliche. But when you're young, your kids are stupid.
I'd have on Bye Bye Bye.
You're stupid too.
that as well, yes. So after they're done jamming out, I guess, they decide to go to Liz's office where they steal checkbooks for the business. And they also managed to get some of his credit cards. So I'm not totally sure if they took them off his body or if they were at his office as well. But Jeff had a key to the office. So they take the credit cards and the checks, and Tim's kind of having a moral meltdown. So they were like, we need to get rid of you. So they buy him a plane ticket and they send him back home. He was from Illinois. So he's out. So once he departs the group, the others spend the next day or so just like going on a shopping spree, spending all of List's money.
Yeah, because again, they're not thinking that this is going to get them caught. They haven't thought right. That far ahead.
Well, in case you want to know what a murderer buys after killing someone, Joey bought some leather pants.
Oh.
And Smiley picked up a suit.
See, now that's a good purchase.
Yeah, especially for the court hearings you're going to have to go to. But
good point.
Yeah. Well, they didn't get a whole lot more shopping done because a cashier at one of the stores must have picked up on some shadiness because the credit card they were using was confiscated, like when they were on the shopping spree.
Yeah.
But they had other cards, they had some cash, and remember, they had his checkbook. The boys get some food, and at some point they stop to see some friends of Jeff's. And as I mentioned earlier, these boys are no criminal geniuses because, of course, they start running their mouths to Jeff's friends about the murder.
Surprise, surprise.
Right? And I don't know exactly how Joey and Jeff were feeling right now, but Smiley seems like he might have been bragging about the killing. Like, this wasn't a confession to Jeff's friends in a, oh my God, guess what I did kind of way. It was like, guess what I did? Like, it was an excitement thing.
It's literally like the past couple weeks, Yogurt Chop and Luna, the perps were doing that.
Yeah. Like, wild. Stop running your mouth. You see, this is what will get me caught because I can't keep a secret. So the boys would leave the friend's house and they would later attempt to buy like $200 worth of heroin, but apparently they ended up getting ripped off. But I don't have any more details than that, but that's karma, guys.
Yeah.
So they end the day by getting a room at a Holiday Inn because we're obsessed with Holiday Inns in this case.
A lot of Holiday.
I know, right? Maybe that was like the only thing in Texas. I don't know.
Could be.
So meanwhile, the day after they killed Bill List, his body is discovered by police officers doing a welfare check. When Bill didn't show up for work that day, one of his employees had called police. So officers were dispatched and they're walking the perimeter of the home. And that's when they peeked in a window and saw blood. And then they saw Bill's body.
Wow.
So a day or so later, the boys attempted to use one of List's company checks at what sources called an ice house, which I had to look up because I didn't know what that was, but it said it could be like a restaurant or like a bar or takeout place.
Yeah. Have you ever been to like the Ice House Deli in Pottstown? Like killer hoagies. Really?
No. Okay. I've never been there.
Yes. That's what it is.
Well, an ice house. You learn something new every day.
We'll go next week.
Okay. Deal.
Okay.
So while attempting to use this check, the guy waiting on them was actually an off-duty cop. And so this was like his part-time job, and it's kind of similar to the cashier during the shopping spree who confiscated the credit card. This off-duty cop must have sensed something was not quite right here because he decided to call List's office to confirm the check. And whoever answered the call was like, no, that check is no good and do not let those guys go. Like, wow. They just committed a
Busted.
Murder.
Yeah.
So police arrive at the restaurant and take Smiley, Jeff, and Joey into custody.
As they should.
And there's unfortunately, like I said, this was very sparsely written about, so there isn't a whole lot of information, but I did find out what happened to the boys. So Jeff ended up pleading down and basically only got charged with like some sort of credit card fraud. He was sentenced to 15 years, but he was paroled after 3. Joey was considered a juvenile and he only got probation. He didn't get anything else. However, it's said that he's been in and out of jail basically the entirety of his life
I'm
up till now.
Surprised by that.
Right. Well, Tim was still in Illinois and he fought extradition for a while, but eventually the prosecutor and police in Texas found out that Tim was dying of AIDS and they decided to drop the extradition. I know that he ended up passing away sometime in the early 90s.
Okay.
And as for Smiley, he is serving a life sentence in a maximum security prison. He apparently got married at some point, but I think he actually only got 45 years for Bill's murder. But because he was on probation for the attack on that kid and stealing his car, this was a big deal. And he ended up getting a life sentence where he's still there today.
Yeah, you want to root for the kid because I do feel what he did was justified, but I think he took it to the next level. Like, this wasn't self-defense. Yes. He was, you know what I mean?
Well,
he should have just went to the cops.
And List had never abused him. Like, Joey, right. I could see him snapping after the shit that happened. But, nothing happened to you, Smiley.
Yeah, he would have got some leeway, I think, if he played his cards differently, but he didn't. So he's where he belongs.
So I'm going to come back to some of the reported hauntings on this mansion property, which is how we started. But real quick, remember how I told you that Bill List's daughter was involved in a true crime in the early 80s?
Mm-hmm.
And this is not long after she reconnected with her dad. Well, her name was Deborah Thornton, and she and her brother Ron, they somehow reconnected with Bill and began working in his trucking company. Mm-hmm. But the reunion didn't last very long because Bill's a monster.
Yeah.
But anyway, while living in Texas, Deborah had gotten into, so she had moved out, stopped working for Bill, whatever. She had gotten into an argument with her husband, and she decided to leave the house to blow off some steam. And sources claim she ended up at a party where she hung out and ended up spending the night with this guy named Jerry Dean. And this total random night that Deborah was with this Jerry Dean guy, around 3 a.m., some of Jerry's acquaintances, a man named Danny Garrett and this woman named Carla, they decided to break into his apartment in hopes of stealing a motorcycle that he was like in the middle of refurbishing.
Okay.
So they ended up killing Jerry with a hammer and a pickaxe.
Oh my God.
It's bad. And yeah. As Danny went to inspect like the rest of the apartment for things to steal, Carla saw movement like under the covers and realized that a woman who we know to be Deborah had been trying to hide. So Carla proceeds to murder Deborah with the pickaxe, ending the vicious attack by embedding the pickaxe in Deborah's heart.
Oh my God.
Wait, it gets worse. Carla would later brag that she experienced, quote, multiple intense orgasms with each blow of the pickaxe.
Get out of here.
End quote.
People, they say that. There's no freaking way.
Who says that? Like, who that's disgusting. Carla and Danny are arrested a few weeks later, and they actually have separate murder trials. And while they're both convicted of and sentenced for Jerry Dean's murder, neither was technically held accountable for Deborah's murder, which is a shame. Like, Carla was initially charged for it, but it was dropped when she agreed to testify against Danny.
Yeah.
And Danny was only ever charged for Jerry Dean because we think Carla killed her.
They must have wanted that conviction bad if they were ready to let her go.
Yeah, seriously. But get this, both of these shitbags were sentenced to death.
Great.
Now, in a surprise to no one, Carla found Jesus while in prison and decided that she was forgiven and felt that she shouldn't be put to death.
As they do.
Well, Danny ended up dying of liver disease in 93 before he was put to death, but Carla was eventually put to death on February 3rd, 1998, via lethal injection.
Good.
This is the most offensive thing of all, but in the dumbest final meal ever, she had a peach, a banana, and a garden salad.
Oh, come on, go nuts.
What a waste.
Finish with a salad. Get out of here.
That's the worst thing I've ever heard.
I don't choose a salad on a good day, let alone my last day.
I've never chosen a salad. Well, in case you haven't put it together yet, Deborah's killer was Carla Faye Tucker.
Yeah.
The infamous pickaxe murderer, a.k.a.
I hadn't put it together.
You didn't? Okay, good. I'm glad. Because I started saying her name at the beginning, and I was like, oh, don't want to say her last name
now,
yet.
But now when you said it like that, when you're like, Carla Faye Tucker, I'm like, now I get it.
Now I get it.
You just had to say it slow.
She was also the first woman to be executed in Texas in 135 years.
Wow. And there's some crazy crimes in Texas. That's surprising. With
isn't
all the
crazy?
That goes down in Texas, yeah.
I know.
Wow.
Well, just to go back to the mansion, the Toddville Murder Mansion, as it became known as, was under control of caretakers for a while. And I found on some different forums that like attempts were made to use this monstrosity of a home for different things. Like They tried to make it a weight loss clinic at some point, but nothing would last there.
Yeah.
Kids would break in. There's tons of pictures online from kids breaking in like the 90s and having parties there.
I believe.
The home was actually rented to a film production group for the filming of a 1994 movie entitled The House on Toddville Road, which is a horror movie, and it uses the home as a backdrop, but the plot has nothing to do with Bill List or the boys.
How do you even pitch that to somebody?
I don't know. I don't think the movie's very good, but apparently you can find it in chunks on YouTube if you're dying to. Cool because you can see the house. Like, I will say that, but
I don't know.
Well, the home was eventually torn down at the end of 95 or early 96. And I think the property sat vacant for quite a while, and then it was eventually purchased and turned into that Villas by the Sea neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is where the whole energy thing comes back. Some people who live in the neighborhood have said that everything's fine there. They've never seen anything creepy. Like, stop making a big deal out of this. However, others have claimed to hear strange noises, or they felt like they were being watched. And they've also claimed to have seen like shadowy figures moving around the property.
Really? I believe that. You hear about it when people die on it, like when you build on sites where there was wars or Indian reservations or things like that, where there's bad things that happen. So I don't know what I believe.
I get tied up, but I do feel like places like Salem and Gettysburg, there's some kind of energy there for sure.
I had my only paranormal experience in Gettysburg, in Devil's Den.
Really?
So, yeah, I was with the scouts, and I literally felt something tug on my backpack, and I was last in line. So that's where, because I thought it was some kid behind me just
right.
tugging on my, it was not. Oh, and I looked, creepy. It didn't get caught on anything. I need things like that to happen to me to say I believe. Like, I'm yes. definitely skeptical. I need hard proof.
Agreed.
And that was the only time in my life that I felt anything kind of otherworldly. So was there an explanation? I don't know.
Well, I guess our friend Nir Golan believed it because he did end up getting out of the lease. However, they said they would not give him a security deposit back. He was going to take them to court, but I couldn't find anything after that. So,
wow.
Isn't that wild? So that's the wild story that I give you like three things in one, like the murder mansion, the murder of Bill List, and the murder of Deborah Thornton.
Yeah. And Maury Troy Travis, just as a bonus.
Yeah. So it's just a whole modge podge of true crime stories.
Mod podge. Mod.
You're a mod podge.
That is a crazy story. And I think it's a great lead in because do we announce who our guest is? I feel like we can.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah, this is big. Like, you guys, every now and then we'll throw in like a crazy big guest. And I mean, this might make Melissa, I don't know, this might make her year.
I'm going to need my inhaler.
So we have the great and powerful Catherine Ramslin lined up for this month.
Oh, the patron saint of Murder Unscripted.
She's on the Mount Rushmore of Murder Unscripted. So
stop it. Oh my God.
So she is wrapped up in so much right now. Like, Catherine has the number one show on HBO, Serial Killer's Apprentice. That was hers. She's just got her hand in so many things. And unfortunately, like, we don't want to talk to her about those things. Like, because she's done so many media appearances lately and just, she's all over talking about that stuff. So we want to bring you a version of Catherine Ramslin that you won't see anywhere else. We're going to talk about paranormal. We're going to talk about more haunted crime scenes. We're going to talk about we'll talk about this case with her. And we're also going to talk about how I was her landscaper for a hot second.
That's so random.
That's very random.
So random. Well, and if you're interested, take a look at her book before she comes on. It's called Haunted Crime Scenes by Catherine Ramslin and Mark Nesbitt.
Yeah, so I feel like this is a good time to, this is where our palate cleansers move in. So all of our initial banter, and I was, the whole time you were talking about this, I was like, what would my street name be? Like, you got Smiley, you got Zero.
Yeah.
I think I would be Sweats. Like, because I just sweat.
Nobody hangs out with Sweats.
Yo, Sweats.
What is your porn star name? Like, you know how.
Okay,
you do your first, I always heard first dog, but I guess your first pet with the street you grew up on.
See, I've heard it's your middle name in the street you grew up on. So no, it would be, it I would like either mine be. Okay, so if it's pet, it would be Floyd Lighty. Or if it's this is way better. If it's middle name, Lawrence Lighty. Oh, that is a porn name if I've ever heard one.
Wait, guess what? What's mine yours? Is? Prissy Blackrock. Isn't that epic?
I think that is a porn star. I'm not positive.
I'm pretty sure. That's my alter ego.
Wow. What do they do every season? They, with Halloween approaching, what's your, like, what is it? A witch name or a ghoul name or a goblin name?
Oh, how do we figure that out?
Is there, hold on. Maybe there's a generator.
Oh my God. I want to know my witch name.
All right. Hold on.
Or my spooky name.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
All right. So my name is Ichabod Cobweb.
That's legit. I like that.
And if we're doing yours, it is Misty McSlaughter.
All right, I'll take it.
There's also Boney McGool, Elvira Ghostface, and Misty Fleshington.
Okay.
I feel like that could also be a porn star name.
I was going to say, I feel like Boney McGool could be like a weird niche of like Halloween porn.
Boney Fleshington.
I'm not going to lie. I would download that.
Wow. Well, that's it, you guys. That's all we got for this week.
Well, we want to know what your porn star name is, or your witch name, or
your Halloween name. Yes.
Or your porn star name.
Throw it all at the wall.
Just let us know. And you know where you can let us know. You can hit us up on our socials at Murder Unscripted. You can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. Or you can drop us a line through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com. So send us those porn star names because we are dying to know them.
The other one is Ludmilla McBitey Face.
I want that
These
one.
These are ridiculous.
I want to be Ludella McBitey Face. That's just call me that. Like, I'm going down to the Social Security office tomorrow to get my name changed.
Ridiculous.
Well, on that note, Ludella and Ichabod are out. So until next week, be safe, stay hydrated, and remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
No, they do not, but they build 30,000 square foot mansions, apparently.
And have poor taste in decorating.
Very.
Bye.
See ya.